From Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Thanks so much for joining me.
William Cooper returns to the show this week. William Cooper is an attorney, national columnist, an award-winning author. His writings have appeared in hundreds of publications around the world, including the New York Times, the Washington Post, CNN, Newsweek, San Francisco Chronicle, Chicago Sun-Times, the Huffington Post, and many others. Publishers Weekly calls his commentary about American politics a compelling rallying cry for democratic institutions under threat in America. He's been with us a couple of times here since he published his essential read, How America Works and Why It Doesn't, A Brief Guide to the U.S. Political System. William Cooper is also a novelist, and I just read his latest. It's an historical novel. It's a political thriller. It's kind of a whodunit as well. It's called The Trial of Donald H. Rumsfeld, a novel. William Cooper, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you, Gary. Appreciate you having me on again. Always enjoy speaking with you.
So you created a fictional character named Donald H. Rumsfeld. How did you ever think of such a ridiculous name for a character?
All my imagination. Seemed like a good name to run with.
I enjoyed the book very much. At a certain point in your book, there's kind of a what-if storyline that emerges. And what I want to ask, and I because it's a novel, so we don't want to give anything away, but up until that what-if point, how much of what you describe in the novel matches the historical record?
Quite a bit. I tried in the first part of the novel to give Rumsfeld's background. Of course, he was a real person and had quite a background in the government, spanning from the early 60s all the way up until the 2000s when he was George W. Bush's Secretary of Defense. And basically up until the Bush administration, when things take a big shift in the fictional direction, the key moments and background and events are from the public record and did happen. Now I get into Rumsfeld's personal thoughts and things like that, which are my own writing, but most of that first part does hew closely to the historical record.
Well, I don't know how much fiction you've written before, but what made you choose to write a novel with Rumsfeld at the center?
I've always been really fascinated by Rumsfeld. So I started paying attention to politics closely as a young adult right after September 11th. That was very jarring for all of us. And I basically went from hardly following politics at all to being very absorbed with it. And he was a central player. So a very formative time for me. And I was really interested in him. He used to give those press conferences on C-SPAN where he'd talk about everything. And I just found him a really sort of fascinating, entertaining mix of personality traits. And I thought he'd make a great centerpiece for a novel. And I love writing fiction. So I took that and that background and that character and just ran with it.
How do you think this book speaks to our current political situation? I mean, if it does.
It definitely does to me in a significant way. I mean, one of the things that I try to do with the book is humanize Rumsfeld. I think we often, me included, you know, we think about these historical figures and, you know, whether it's contemporary or historical, these big figures, we sometimes forget that they're human beings like we are. And sometimes people whose policies we despise are very good people, you know, in their everyday life with their family or vice versa. So I really wanted to humanize Rumsfeld. And I also, as part of that, wanted to remind people that those that have all this power in our country, as a country, we repose tremendous power and a very small number of people, especially in foreign affairs, are human beings subject to all the fallibilities as everyone else. You and I have talked at length about the current administration as you know, I'm not a big fan. So I think it's very important to be wildly aware of how dangerous it is to have deeply flawed human beings with tons of power. And I can't think of a time where that's been more relevant.
You have one of my favorite of Rumsfeld's characteristics that you created for your book is that he loves seeing his name in the newspaper. So it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter under what context, but he gets a chill when he sees his name. It's a thrill chill when he sees his name in the paper.
He does. And there may be somebody in Washington, D.C. who likes to see his name in the press as well. perhaps the most powerful of them all right now. But yeah, ego, you know, it's inherent in the system. You run for office, you have all this power, the ego, there's not an average size ego in the Oval Office or at the Pentagon. And what happens with ego far too often, and I try to convey this point, is when people who are otherwise intelligent, rational people get swept up in their own legacy, their own ego, their own arrogance, it can cripple their decision-making. And with Rumsfeld, he was famous for being this person who articulated these tiers of knowledge, right? The known knowns, known unknowns, unknown unknowns. It was actually an articulate framework, but his signature defining moment was violating that, not recognizing that he didn't know whether or not Iraq had weapons of mass destruction, not knowing that he couldn't turn Iraq into this vibrant democracy. So it was that irony, great historical irony with him, I found fascinating.
Well, that's, you know, that's one of the most interesting moments, I think, in 21st century history. The fact that the 9/11, 2001 attacks occurred, but then our reaction to not only go to war with Afghanistan, but to go to war with Iraq, and it's sort of the centerpiece of your story. So I wonder how much of what you wrote there do you think is an accurate depiction of how we got involved in that conflict?
I think that the motivations in the book with Rumsfeld and Cheney and the tension with others in the administration like Condoleezza Rice and Colin Powell, I think they're, from what I can tell, they were true. I'm sure I didn't capture it with precision, but my understanding of the administration was there were tensions between those wings, so to speak, and that ultimately the Rumsfeld-Cheney wing carried the day with George W. Bush. And then after Iraq didn't go well, when Cheney and John Bolton, who was in the administration as well, and Les Rumsfeld, who left during Bush's second term, they were actually, believe it or not, they actually were pushing to go into Iran. And George W. Bush, you know, thankfully said, look, you guys convinced me to go to Iraq. Now you're trying to get me to go to Iran. You know, no way. No, thank you. But I think the tension there with Iraq was present. Maybe I got it right. Maybe I got it wrong. But I at least tried, maybe in a little bit of an exaggerated sense, to add drama and entertaining value. But I tried to capture that tension. And I think at least some of it was there.
Well, it is a really entertaining novel. I really enjoyed reading it, William Cooper. Just remind my listeners that the title is called The Trial of Donald H. Rumsfeld, a novel. One of the nice things about reading a novel in times like this is that you can forget about times like this, although this novel doesn't actually give you that particular opportunity, because you can't help but think about the ramifications of the actions of the George W. Bush administration and how it led us to our current situation. Although you also have to think back at, and I remember thinking, you know, when George W. Bush was president, oh my God, how could things get worse? And then of course they got so much worse. It's like, you have to have a little bit of nostalgia for a political period in which you know, none of them are self-serving. They're all thinking about what's best for the country, even if we don't agree with their decisions.
Yeah, I appreciate you saying that, because I think it's that's really important and true. We had huge problems and always have, to some degree, had problems with the wrong people assuming positions of authority and mistakes being made at various times. But I do think 25 years ago, the motivations, you know, 20, 25 years ago during the George W. Bush administration, the general direction of the motivations was traditional, if not misguided in various ways. Whereas now we have sadly crossed a very disturbing threshold into territory where the not only the motivations, but the overt actions and statements are clearly consistently coming from the wrong place and not about the well-being of the country or the interests of the country, but rather the self-aggrandizement of Trump. You know, I don't think there's any debate that when he's making billions with his own meme coins, his intentions are not for the broader well-being of the United States.
Well, let's set aside your novel just for a bit and talk a little bit about our current political situation, because you do know so much about the way government should work and about the Constitution, which is in, I mean, I don't think we're going into a constitutional crisis, or I think we're in one. I think there's a constitutional crisis on a daily basis right now. You've written a lot about tribalism in your previous book. We talked about that. And it seems to me that something has snapped. I saw an article in the New York Times the other day called "Why is Taylor Swift so polarizing?" And my thought was, well, everything is polarizing. And I think it's gotten worse since the Charlie Kirk thing. What are your thoughts?
I like the use of your word "snapped" is a very good one. I feel like that could be a good title for a book about the state of America. The subtitle would have to be refined, but "snapped" is a great
the pop
place. That's a great place to start because it captures it well. I agree. I mean, that's my thesis. I agree that Charlie Kirk accelerated it. It's very disturbing. I think the fact that we have not everybody, but huge swaths of the country so reflexively tribal about everything, Taylor Swift, I mean, everything, it's terrible because it warps thinking. It just utterly and completely warps thinking. There are studies that repeated studies over and over again that show if you present an idea to a group of people that are interested in politics and you label it with one political party, you'll get a set of stats. And then if all you do, the only thing that changes is the political party, the stats dramatically change. So it'll go from favorable to unfavorable, vice versa. And then I think that's inherent in human nature. And the Trump era has just thrown gasoline on that fire. And it's very unfortunate. And ultimately, the longer this goes, I think the more it deteriorates our basic systems of government that we rely on to keep a civilized society.
Well, so in that way, it would be important for opponents of the current administration to point out anything that the current administration has done that is positive and applaud those things so that we could then move away from this tribalization, polarization. So let me ask you, Will, what are the great things that have been accomplished during the first 8-10 months of the Trump administration?
You're gonna have to give me a moment.
There's not a bunch of them that just jump out at you.
I too succumb to tribalism. I try to keep it to a as much a limited degree as I possibly can. But I am definitely admit that I'm a victim of it as well. And it is hard for me to think of positive things. I will say one example that I think is worth noting so far. These things change, but presidents always, in my opinion, unfairly, they always get held responsible for the economy. Democrats are very quick to point out when Obama did well with the stock market when we came out, climbed out of the financial crisis, for example. And so far, to this date, the performance of the U.S. economy has been strong under Trump in a variety of ways. There are warning signs. There are red flags. I personally think his tariff policy and other policies have been economically illiterate. However, if we're going to judge a president by the results, we should acknowledge that the facts about the economy and the stock market under Trump are what they are, and generally speaking, they're positive.
I was just reading today that the trade war escalation with China has caused a massive drop or wild fluctuation in the stock market. I don't know that much about stocks.
Overall, the stock market's done really well under Trump, this in his second term as president, and there's been a recent dip, but the overall numbers are very strong. I actually think the way he approaches trade discussions is extremely counterproductive, but the robustness of the United States economy is just unbelievable, and it so far withstood a lot of his mistakes. But the way he goes about communicating about these things with other countries and the extreme lurching from one thing to the next, it's all very counterproductive. But again, the robustness of the United States economy, trillions and trillions of dollars and hundreds of millions of private actors, I think it enables him at least so far to get away with it. And the broad trends that were already in place when he started, you know, have continued.
So I asked you to tell me positive things about the Trump administration. You prefaced that one by saying the president has nothing to do with it and then said that it was one of them. So let me try again. Is there anything else you can think of that you would say, oh, you know, yeah, okay. I mean, I don't like this, this, and this, but this is a solid thing.
Well, I think there are narratives out there that are wrong. That are sort of anti-Trump narratives that are wrong. I think there's a lot of anti-Trump narratives that are right, but I think some of the anti-Trump narratives are wrong. One example is I do not think the administration in any sort of significant way has ignored or violated court orders. And I actually think that's a very important factor for us to remember. But that's not really answering your question. You're asking me to affirmatively praise something, the administration, and I'm having a hard time. So maybe I'm an example of the tribalism that I criticize, or maybe we just happen to have intrinsically nothing to praise. I don't know.
Oh, that's scary, but interesting. What about the future of elections in America? You have expressed to me that you had no fear that elections were going to take place and that they would be, sound and safe elections. Do you still feel that way?
Well, I'd be very surprised if the elections themselves didn't take place. We've had elections in recent months. We had a major presidential election a year ago. There was very little if any, sense that there were fundamental problems there. If Trump had lost, he would have never shut up about the fraud. But the actual evidence, just like when Trump lost and when Trump won the first time, the actual evidence is that these elections keep happening, and they keep being done in a good, sound way. And that was true when Trump lost and said his seat was stolen, which was all BS, and that it was true when he won, and it continues to be true at midterm elections and special elections. What I worry about, and this is a huge concern, is underlying degradation of the vote in really significant ways. Gerrymandering it's done openly and it's done by both sides. So that suggests that it's not that bad, but it's actually unbelievably horrific and subverts our democracy in profound ways. People worry about, oh, these six people at the polling station last week didn't vote because they didn't have their ID. Gerrymandering disenfranchises millions of people in one fell swoop. Entire swaths of states effectively lose their vote. So that's a huge problem. I also worry that we already know Trump will do whatever he can to stay in office, even if he loses. We saw that for multiple months straight after he lost to Biden. He did everything he could to stay in power. He just failed to do it. I worry that the Republicans will lose, and either Trump or J.D. Vance or someone like that, who's an incumbent, will try similar things and be more successful. So I have worries. This is a big problem. And there's other problems. There's other laws in other states that can disenfranchise people in ways that are. So it's an area of big concern. But the elections themselves seem to be functioning well, and that's important and something that we should be thankful for.
What do you think about?
Go ahead.
Yeah, what do you think about Governor Gavin Newsom's plan in California, Proposition 50, I believe it is, to enable more gerrymandering in California to counter the gerrymandering that Republicans are doing?
It's as distasteful as it is easy. You absolutely have to do it. The alternative is way worse. We cannot hand the Republicans the House of Representatives, which is what we would be doing if we didn't support this response. So our polity is in the midst of a race to the bottom with this. That's very unfortunate. And yet we absolutely have to respond to from California, have to respond. Because if we don't, then the Republicans will just find a sustainable majority through all of their gerrymandering.
What is your sense about the chances of this proposition being successful in the election then?
I haven't studied it closely, actually, so I don't have an informed view on that. My fingers are crossed that it passes. Sitting on our hands while all of this gerrymandering and disenfranchisement takes place in red states, that would be, especially in the Trump era, and he may have somebody who comes after him who is more similar than Trump than we'd like. Having Congress be a effective safeguard against the executive in the ways that Congress can be is really, really important. So my fingers are crossed it passes.
Donald Rumsfeld said something about inaction in your book. Inaction is weakness. What is it? What is the phrase you said?
So weakness is provocative is the phrase that Rumsfeld used a lot in real life and uses a lot in the book. Uh-huh. And then relatedly, he says in the book, which he said in real life too, inaction is just as big a decision as action.
Right, right. Very amazing. Well, another thing about thinking about your book, your novel, William Cooper, The Trial of Donald H. Rumsfeld, a novel, is the idea that there are that personality plays into politics in an interesting way. That is, Donald Trump is largely a personality. I mean, before he was president, he was on the covers of magazines. He was on television. He was on the covers of magazines and newspapers. And the New York Times gave him a lot of coverage. Saturday Night Live had him host. It had very little to do with his political abilities or experiences. He had none. do you think that that's a trend that will continue? I think Rumsfeld deals with the idea that his superiors have less experience and knowledge than he does in your novel.
I think it probably will be a trend. I don't think it'll. I think it could easily be quite nonlinear in the sense that we're not just going to have every president be a reality TV star. But I remember I was blown away when Arnold Schwarzenegger won as governor. And then, Trump is much worse of a figure than Arnold in a variety of ways and became president. But I think what we've seen is both an understanding of and a respect for the basic designs of our constitutional system aren't relevant to a huge percentage of the country. And as soon as that premise is set, which it has been, it's open season for whoever can get the most attention to win the Oval Office.
Well, I want to ask you one more question about your novel. When you were writing it, did you, before you started writing it, did you have your ending?
I had the ending in general in mind, yes. And I wrote the last part of the book pretty early. I mean, I edited it after, but I wrote it pretty early. John Irving is a great author, and he says that he writes the last line of every book first. I didn't go that far, but I did set the ending, and actually the last few pages weren't even edited very much because I put a lot of work into them really early on. Because I wanted to make a point with the ending, and where I wanted to go in general hung on the ending quite a bit. So it came early. I'm curious, is that question just a general question, or was there something about it that made you curious?
Well, I mean, when I talked about this book at the beginning, I mentioned that it's kind of a whodunit, which it is. And I realized that there's a certain point in the book where I was like, wait a minute, I have this question, which is not resolved until the very end. And and you planted the seed very well for that, and so I wonder if you went backwards to do that, or if it was happening in real time as you were writing.
I definitely a dimension of going backwards.
Yeah, I really enjoyed the novel, and I think my listeners will as well. It's if you like politics and you like thrillers and you like thinking, then I highly recommend it. It's called The Trial of Donald H. Rumsfeld, a novel, and you must read, if you haven't already, How America Works and Why It Doesn't, A Brief Guide to the U.S. Political System, and the author of both, my guest, William Cooper. Thanks so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
Awesome. Thanks for having me, Gary. I really appreciate that you let me keep coming on. I thought of a way to praise Trump.
Okay, good.
I could. It took a long time, and it's still Trump supporters will still find this lacking.
Okay.
But he clearly understands the government better today than he did when he showed up in 2016. When he showed up in 2016, he was, I don't think it's an overstatement to say, constitutionally illiterate. He even said early on, it reads like a foreign language. And I don't think he knew that there were articles of the I just think he knew virtually nothing about the federal government. He is now still a meager percentage of a true constitutional scholar, but he gets it a lot more, and I think that's a compliment, and I think that's something that should be acknowledged. He's not. And he's been in the system for 9 years, so you would think that that would be true, and I think it is true. So does that count, or am I still
too tribal to even
really praise him?
Here's the thing. Yes, he knows a lot more now, and therefore he can subvert it easier because he knows what's against him, so he can sidestep it.
I don't disagree. I was trying to praise him, but the best I could do. But yes, that is a fair extension of the praise.
Well, we'll have to work on this for next time. What are you going to write now?
My next book is a psychology book about bias and human behavior. It's similar, although different to, obviously different to Thinking Fast and Slow by Danny Kahneman. He was the great genius of the field, and I'm a lay person trying to just write a book that's helpful in sort of everyday life for people to think about biases and quirks. I wrote in How America Works, there's a big section on bias and politics. And so it's an area that I'm really interested in. And then after this, I think I'm going to look at the last few books I've written and maybe pick a field and stick with it for a while, because I'm bouncing around a little too much. But I do want the next one to be the psychology book. And I'd be grateful if you would have me back on when it's ready, although we're a year or two out from that one.
I'll be here and I'll be looking forward to it. And I'm sure we'll talk a couple of times at least before then.
I'd love that. Yeah.
William Cooper, the book, his novel, The Trial of Donald H. Rumsfeld, a novel. Thanks so much. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, Gary.
I want to welcome Lisa Endo Cooper and Bremond Barry McDougall back to the show. They're old friends of each other and new friends of mine. You met them a couple of months ago here on From the Bookshelf. They are the founders of a wonderful imprint, publishing imprint, called Quite Literally Books. And last time they told us about their company and about their first three releases, and now they're back with three new books. So welcome back to From the Bookshelf. It's nice to see you guys.
Thank you for having us back.
We're excited to be back.
So before we talk about the three new books, how are things going? You guys have a sort of a possibly tilting at windmills philosophy of not distributing your books through that online place that everybody goes and gets their books. So how is that working out, and how are things going, and how were the sales on your first three books?
Well, much like Don Quixote, I think the people who are in the business of books think we're nuts. and we may be. I mean, it's possible, but we didn't want to not try, and really give it an honest chance. So, we had our first set of books come out in April, We have our next set of books available for pre-order right now, but they'll be hitting newsstands, or maybe not newsstands, but bookshelves near you on November 7th.
Yes.
And so we haven't been doing this for a full year yet of selling, but how is it going? It is hard, and the learning curve has been very steep. Mm-hmm. But we're learning a lot, and we are selling books. So I think that our philosophy is definitely resonating with some people out there, and we're producing a product that I think is special. And so when people hold it and see it for themselves, they know that it is.
They tend to get very excited about it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
No, I can understand that. They want it. Just to remind our listeners, so the books, they have, they match up really nice, and they have kind of, they're paperback, but they have like dust covers with a little flap. And the artwork on them is really attractive, and they're only available as books. You can't get these versions as ebooks.
Right. That's correct. Yeah, one of the things that we're trying to do is just to make actual book reading a pleasure again, a pleasure still.
Yeah.
We never stopped reading them, and a lot of people haven't. But yeah, we're trying to make it sort of a holistic experience of like the best paper, the most beautiful design. You know, even the sizing is done so that the font is easy on the eyes. It's not large print, but it's not, you know, micro print. And yeah,
it's clear. It's easy to read.
It's a pleasure to read. The size of the book in your hand feels good. It's got lay flat binding. Like just, it's a very thought out book.
So after you read it, it still looks nice.
It does.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I think those of us who never left physical books completely will love this, but also, you know, there's sort of a movement of people to stop watching and listening and doing everything on their phone and their computer and actually sit with a book. And mm-hmm. so we're hoping to tap into some of that as well.
That return to a love of those things analog, you know, it's like, I think our books are sort of like the return to vinyl version of reading.
Well, do you consider what you're doing to be political?
I don't think we went into it. We didn't go into it thinking we were being political, but it turns out the very act of reading and publishing has become very political. So yes.
Yeah. And yeah, more so in the last year, I think, probably than
more so
than
in the
ever
last
before. 6 months.
Yeah.
Well, you said there was a steep learning curve. What are some of the things that you've learned?
We learned that marketing is not the same as sales. I learned that
it's true. Like you can make the most incredible product in the world, and if you can't get it out in the world, then it's just sitting in your best friend's basement, for example. I mean, I'm not saying that happened to us, but
I think we got over the learning curve of like how to make a book fairly easily. Like we identified books that were good. We
fairly easily the course of 3 years,
but like that felt doable to us. And then working with Louise Feely to design the covers, and working with Anthony Russo, who designed the first covers, then Megan Mulholland, who designed the second set of covers, that all felt like a hard thing to learn, but we were learning it.
Well, that was
business,
fun.
But it was fun.
That was
the
fun.
Business part of it has been harder for both of us because neither of us is a business person.
It's not fun. If you're not into sales, it's not fun, but that is a very real part of it.
Yeah.
And, so yes, I think that's
the
probably,
the
long answer. The short answer is making a book, marketing a book, and selling a book are three very separate processes.
Yes.
And we are learning that.
We think we're really good at one.
Making the book.
Better at the other two.
Well, they are really beautiful books, and I want you guys to be successful, which is why I wanted you to come back and see us again. So tell me about, before we talk about the three new ones, let's review the first three ones that are available right now, and everybody should get them and read them, especially even if you don't read them, get them and put them right here on your shelf because they look great.
It's true. Yes. They look great on a shelf. So if you just want to admire them from afar, please do.
And also gift-giving season is right around the corner.
Oh, yeah. So these are nice gifts. So talk real quickly about the first three.
So we had The Homemaker by Dorothy Canfield Fisher, which is sort of a role reversal. Husband stays home and wife goes to work, which is but in 1924, which certainly adds a wrinkle to it. We had Plum Bun by Jesse Redmond Fawcett, which is a sort of a novel of passing of a black woman who looks white and decides to live as a white woman in 1928. So that's also a long time ago. And both of those books sort of hit on themes that we're still talking about that are still relevant today. And then The Pink House by Amelia Gardner White, which is just a good read. It's just a good sort of gothic novel, family saga.
Secrets, romance.
Yeah.
Mean cousins.
Yeah. Exactly. Orphaning.
And oatmeal as a comfort food. I don't know. It's yeah.
So that's in a nutshell. Those are the first three.
Burr likes to say that The Pink House is like a curl up on your sofa mm-hmm. with a cup of tea kind of read. You know, it's cozy. It's perfect for our weather today.
I know. It's kind of gray and chilly.
Pink House kind mm-hmm. of day.
It is.
Yeah.
Well, fall is coming, which it means gift giving time, as we were mentioning. So Lisa and Bremont, tell me about the three new books that we can get from Quite Literally Books.
Yeah, so Quite Literally Books number 4 is called Her Land by Charlotte Perkins Gilman. And I think probably a lot of people have heard of that name because she also wrote a short story called The Yellow Wallpaper that is quite well known, especially if you took a certain kind of course in college.
Even high school English. My kids all read it in their high school English classes. It's read.
The classic.
Herland is sort of a story of a utopia. It's a 2,000-year-old civilization that is peopled only by women. There are no men in sight because they have figured out how to reproduce. Actually, I love this part, so I'm going to tell you about it. They've learned how to reproduce just by longing for it. It is the ultimate. It is the ultimate evolution and expression of choice.
Yeah.
Because they just want it.
All you have to do is want it bad enough and
whoop. Nature takes its course. And if you don't want it, that's okay too.
You don't get it
if you don't want it. And so basically these three exploring men from America, I believe, well, they decide that Herlian needs discovering. So they do. And each of the men sort of represents like a type of man, I guess. And they do find their way there. And it's all about what happens when a bunch of men discover a thriving utopia that's full of women.
And what year was this written?
This was written in 1915. And it's interesting because this one, Charlotte Perkins Gilman had a magazine. So this was serialized. And you can kind of tell the chapters, you know, like each one is like, dun, 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 at the end. And then it starts, you know, with like a compelling first sentence. So it's a great read. And again, a really wonderful moment to be talking about this when so many rights of women are under attack.
Under attack, yeah. It's kind of a science fiction kind of sounds like in a way.
It is. Yeah. Absolutely. If you like Ursula K. Le Guin, if you like, anything that has sort of a futuristic bent to it and a little bit of, it's not magical realism. It's all based in science. We just don't know what it is. They figured a lot of stuff out. Mm-hmm. Perfectly draining roads. And
it's also the
men who happen upon her land, and they name it her land. Just like they just cannot get over the fact that there aren't any men. They just cannot believe it, that women could have made a society that works so well and is engineered so well. Like they're engineers and architects and doctors and, you know, all the things. And then if you want to be a gardener, it's kind of like, do you remember there's a Babar book? One of the Babar books where everyone in the kingdom has just the right job for them.
Or like a Richard Scarry book.
Yeah.
That too.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a really, and it's not very long. It's a quick read, but it will spark a lot of conversation, yeah. I think.
It sounds wonderful. All right. What's the next one?
The next one is called Who Would Have Thought It? By Maria Amparo Ruiz de Burton. This one was written in, is it 1892?
1872.
So wow. It is quite old. It's the first, Maria Amparo Ruiz de Burton was a Mexican-American woman. She was born in Mexico, in Baja California, ended up living, married to an American and living in California. And it's the first novel written in English by a Mexican-American author for an English-speaking audience. And it is,
we call it a sweeping saga. Yeah. It's a satire. You like to say it's by, it sort of has that like Mark Twain kind of mm-hmm. feel to it. And it does. It's a yarn. Lots of crazy characters, charlatans and rogues, and a huge cast of characters. Yes. And really short chapters with like kind of funny headings. But basically, the long and short of it, and it will be the short of it. The book itself is very long, but in a good way. This guy, Dr. Norval, fine, upstanding abolitionist from New England, is, I don't know what he's doing in California. He's out west somewhere, and then he makes his way back home to his family, you know, on the eve of the Civil War, and he's got with him this orphaned girl named Lola. And he announces to his family that they're going to be taking care of Lola because she has been entrusted to him. And Lola has been recently released from capture by some Native American tribe, and they have darkened her skin. So she presents as a child who is Black. And this throws the entire pious, fine, upstanding abolitionist Norval clan into a total,
complete tizzy.
Yeah, total tizzy. And it's further complicated by the fact that Lola is very, very rich. So she comes with treasure, dark skin and treasure. Mm-hmm. And that, as you can imagine,
tough thing to grapple with.
Yeah.
And poor sweet Lola, she is the focus of the whole novel, more or less, but we also almost never get to hear from her.
Right.
She is pulled from one place to another and one character to another. Anyway, it's a really compelling look at the Civil War, look at
race in America.
Race in America, yeah, American history.
Just basically calling out a lot of hypocrisies that are the underpinnings, unfortunately, of American society. And that is why we reprinted it, is because it unfortunately feels very relevant today.
Very contemporary story. Yes. Written over 100 years ago. That's amazing. Well, yep.
And do you want to hear about our last book?
We'll be quicker.
It is quick.
Okay, so this one is called The Little Dinner. It's by Christine Terhune Herrick, and she was the Martha Stewart of her day. This was written in 1892. She was a housewife at one point, but then her husband up and died of typhoid fever and left her with two little kids. And so she started writing, and she wrote over 30 books on housekeeping, homemaking, cooking, child rearing, and she was the voice of her day and all those subjects. And we love cookbooks because they're actually really interesting, but we love this one because Christine Terhune Herrick, God bless her, is funny. She is so snarky. We were surprised to hear that voice coming from, you know, a book that was written in 1892 by someone who's like telling you to, you know, how to make a clear consommé. But the little intros that she does to each part of her book are full of like little snarky.
Mm-hmm. Some of them are kind of laugh out loud. I mean, Lisa and I, when we were reading it to each other, would be like, oh, wait, listen to this.
Yeah.
We have not yet tried any of the recipes. We intend to.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And stay some of them, tuned. You know, lettuce saute. Who knows?
Lettuce saute. Like
lettuce saute.
And at the time she wrote this, it was sort of, I mean, it was revolutionary, right? It's called The Little Dinner because it's a menu of 5 to 6 courses. And it's supposed to be for someone who's on a budget.
And doesn't have a lot of help.
And at the time, you know, people were giving like 14 course meals and serving, you know, a dozen people at their dinner table. And so this was sort of a revolutionary thing to say is okay. And it's very funny because that in and of itself is supposed to be like off the beaten path, right? But then be that as it may, Christine has a lot of rules and a lot of protocol that she would like you to follow. Okay. If you're going to go off the beaten path, this is not off-roading.
She was on her PM.
It's not off-roading, folks. There's still a path and you need to be on it. But it's funny. And so, yes, we're going to try some of them. There's a recipe for canned peas in it.
My great grandmother probably would have followed.
I know. Well, that's one of the ones I'm the most excited about.
Well, so now I'm picturing you guys reading books out loud to each other, sitting at a desk, sitting on the bed. I don't know. When you're a teenager still, but I mean, so when did you? How do you decide which of these six? Do you have a stack? Do you have the next three and the next three and the next three?
No, I mean, it's kind of funny. There's definitely a research process that we go through that we adhere to. But for example, The Little Dinner jumped out at me. I was like at a used bookstore and I found this cute little, I like the cover, to be honest. The cover was super cute. And we'll even show you, even though your listeners
see it. Take my word for it, listeners. It's cute. Yeah.
And I picked it up and I opened it to like a random page. And then I was like snorting, you know, with laughter in the bookstore. And I was like, I gotta get this. You know, I'm texting her. And then Her Land was something. So that was sort of a research one because we were like, because we were like, oh, we love this, you know, short story, The Yellow Wallpaper. What else did she write? Well, turns out she was very prolific. And
Her Land, I love this book. I think it's just, it's just so good. Like just those women are just so on it and they do know how to do everything and they do have pockets in all the right places and they do, you know, they just don't need those guys. And I think that's so awesome.
Well, yeah. I won't be offended.
I mean, I have a husband I love, I have a son I love, but nevertheless.
Yeah, I mean, he sort of posits, you know, like what would happen if women actually did not just rule the world? What if it was just women? Like, what could that look like? And I don't think that really has been fully explored.
I guess there wouldn't be a president, according to recent.
Right. That is correct. There wouldn't be so many things.
Yeah.
I want to ask you, of your first three books that are out there and people are buying, have you found one is more popular than another, or are people just buying all three?
Well, that's a really interesting question. And it's kind of like ebbed and flowed, like depending. For some reason, when we first put these out, I think The Homemaker was selling the best.
Probably because it was the first.
Mm-hmm. It was number one, but we released them all at the same time. Mm-hmm. But yeah, maybe people just were drawn to the first one. But now I would say that both Plum Bun and The Pink House recently has really caught up. Mm-hmm. And I don't really know why that is. They're so different in themes that I think there's a little bit of something here for everyone. And that is something we think about when we put out our set of three. Like we're looking for things that feel like they can sit together. Like there is sort of like a thematic consistency in them. Maybe kind of deep and maybe it only makes sense to us, but there is something about them that go together and we really want them to be very different because we want to appeal to different readers. Like we would love it if you get all of our books, but if you're not a huge reader or a book person, I can guarantee you one of these six is going to appeal to you because they are all over the place.
But I think the first three, for bookstore orders, I think they're pretty much across the board, even though bookstores generally only order one title. So some stores order Plum Bun and some order Pink House, but it has sort of evened out, which is kind of weird.
Well, yeah. And recently, bookstores are actually ordering more.
Yeah.
Because I think in the first run, you know, we were new, they didn't know, they would try it. But again, like we're saying, if you get it in your hands, like, you know that this book is a little bit different. And so our second round has been selling, like, bookstores are now ordering all three, which is kind of nice. Yeah.
And will the next three match size and shape with the first three if I put them on my shelf?
Yes, they will lie harmoniously together on your bookshelf. And we actually have, I think we have three more colors. Yeah. We have a palette of nine that we're going to play with over time. So yes, I think they look like macarons.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. They're not Easter eggy. They're like French macaron. Yeah. Is am I saying that right?
Macaron. They're not macaroons.
And they look yummy is how they look. We play with them. We put them up. So Vermont has incredible bookshelves in her house, and we like to sort of set them up there and see how they look with everything else. Mm-hmm. And I can tell you that they look divine. Yeah.
Well, they are aesthetically pleasing as well as great. Yes. And we've been talking with Lisa Endo Cooper and Bremond Barry McDougall. They're the publishers and they're the creators of Quite Literally Books. They have six titles available, and where can they people get them?
Please go to quiteliterallybooks.com and order our books from our website. And we've got I think we have a pre-order deal right now that if you order the next three books, we'll give you a beautiful Quite Literally Books tote bag.
And these are not your normal run-of-the-mill tote bags.
They're really good.
They have all kinds of interior pockets, and they can hold not just your books, they can hold like your life.
They're super sturdy.
They're super sturdy, yes. And they're not huge. They're just really well designed, if I do say so.
Yeah.
So that's what you're doing with the profits is making tote bags. All right.
Our profits are like we go and buy more books.
Exactly. Bookstores. Exactly. So, yes, please go to our website and order. If you're at your local bookstore, you can ask them to order from Asterism.
You can also directly order from us now. You can order wholesale.
Yes, and we will wholesale also. If your bookstore does not have an account with Asterism, who's our distributor, we can wholesale to them. So have them give us a call.
Yeah.
All right. So if they visit Bookshop Santa Cruz, no doubt. They'd be able to get your books there.
Correct.
Fantastic. All right, Lisa Endo Cooper, Bremond Barry McDougall, I look forward to talking with you when the next batch comes out. Thank you so much.
We'll be ready.
Always a pleasure.
Thanks.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next time. In the meantime, you can check out our website at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts. You can even get your smart speaker to play From the Bookshelf by saying, "Alexa, play Gary Shapiro's From the Bookshelf." And she will. Until next time, for From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. Take care. See you soon.